20 minutes later. "I'm running late," I texted back. "I'll be there as soon as I can." I wasn't sure why I'd lied. I didn't know why I was standing in the hotel bathroom staring at my reflection. Why was I there to meet Matthew Brennan, of all people? The strip lighting was harsh, the mirror speckled with black dots, a cheap off-white laminate covering the sink countertop. I had suggested that I meet him at his house, but Matthew said no.
"I can't ask you to come all the way to Killiney," he said. "It's too far. I'll book somewhere near Houston. That'll be easier for you."
We arranged to meet at this hotel at 6 p.m., and I hadn't been able to think about anything else for the last 2 days.
"Are you listening to me at all, Sarah?"
my father had said when he rang yesterday to tell me the results of his blood tests.
"You seem fierce distracted."
"I'm fine, Dad," I replied. And then today, when I told Mrs. Burke that I couldn't stay for the staff meeting, her eyes narrowed.
"Are you all right?" she asked me. "I hope you're not coming down with anything. Again?"
"Of course not," I replied. "I have a dental appointment I can't reschedule." And I walked out of school, knowing that I should stay. I couldn't afford to annoy her. Not after the disciplinary meeting, the "you've let us down," and "the pupils deserve more." "I'm sorry," I'd said. "I'll do better," I'd said. "It won't happen again."
"Matthew, are you still up for this?"
I don't know. I had been texting Matthew for a couple of weeks now, and every time my phone beeped, I felt a rush of excitement. Yesterday, he had described in excruciating detail what he wanted to do to me, what he was going to do to every inch of my body, and my breath fell short thinking about it. Matthew was older, experienced. He would understand what I needed.
"I came twice last night,"
Kira used to tell us at school after she'd lost her virginity to Owen.
"Jamesy makes me come so hard that I feel like I'm going to pass out,"
Aisling would reply, and I would nod, pretending that I felt the same about Tige Carey, who seemed to think my clitoris and belly button resided in the same area. I could only orgasm when I was alone, on my stomach and breathing into my pillow so that my father wouldn't hear me. But I couldn't tell Kira and Aisling about that. Girls weren't supposed to do that.
"Sarah, nearly there." The lift took me to the first floor. The corridor was long and narrow, the carpet fraying at the edges. It smelled musty with a faint hint of chlorine. Room 63. I knocked.
"Listen, Tony,"
Matthew said as he opened the door, holding his finger up to his lips to silence me. The room was small. There was a generic print of a Johannes Vermeer painting beside a black-framed window on the opposite wall, lace curtains turning the world outside opaque.
"I don't care what Geraghty says. This is a million-euro development. Figure it out."
I could hear Tony speak, but Matthew cut him off, throwing his phone on the coffee table. "A million-euro development?"
"It doesn't matter." "Jesus, look at you."
He held my face in his hands. He could kill me, I thought, and easily. A snap of the neck and an abandoned body. No one knew I was here with him, in this room. Not even Fionn.
"It's nice to see you too, Brennan," I said.
"Now that I have you here, I hardly know what to do with you."
"We could," I began, but he pushed me into the door, the handle pressing into my lower back. He pulled my polo neck off and shoved my skirt down, scooping his hand under my legs and throwing me onto the bed. He unbuttoned his shirt and the flies of his trousers, lips moving down my stomach.
"Wait."
"What?"
He lifted his head.
"I don't like that," I said.
Legs spread open, wondering what they're thinking, what they're going to tell their friends. Body tense. "Relax," they always say, but I can't. He smirked.
"That's because you've only been with boys until now."
"No, I'm serious. I really don't..."
"Shush," he said. "You'll enjoy it this time."
A few minutes later, I was pretending to come, writhing in ecstasy,
anything to make it stop. He crawled back up my body and lifted my hips, shoving himself inside me before I could tell him that he needed to put on a condom. He felt huge, and this time I gasped for real. He dragged me into a kneeling position and thrust again from behind.
"You like that, don't you?"
he said, pushing my body into the headboard. I flipped my hair, looking at him over my shoulder, and I told him that I liked it. I told him to do it to me again.
"I'm close,"
he said and pulled out, something hot across my skin. He collapsed on the bed next to me, groaning.
"Jesus,"
he kept saying.
"Jesus. Thank you for that,"
he said to me after a few minutes.
"What a lovely way to spend an evening."
"Yeah," I said, but I didn't move. I stared at the velour fabric of the headboard, my fingers resting in one of its diamond-shaped indentations. I listened to my breathing, trying to find my way back into my body. It had all happened so quickly.
"You all right?"
he asked me.
"You're very quiet."
"I'm fine," I hesitated. "Okay, listen, I feel awkward even bringing this up, and I don't want to be a pain, but have you been tested recently?"
"Tested?"
"You know, for STIs.
"STIs, how are you?"
he snorted.
"Listen, the women I sleep with are all clean."
"The women? The women?"
"Anyway, I hate condoms," he said. "You can't feel anything with them on."
"Yeah," I said. "I guess." He stood up, stretching his arms overhead. "Are you going already?"
"I have to go to Oris and Ugtaron for an event to attract foreign investment in the property market," he said as he pulled on his shirt. "I know that sounds outrageously obnoxious, but this is my world, Sarah."
He tied his shoelaces.
"Feel free to tell me to get lost. I know I'm a nightmare."
"It's fine," I said, picking up my underwear. "I have stuff to do this evening anyway." He was in the bathroom, the door open as he washed his hands.
"I'm sure you do. I've no doubt you're a busy girl as well."
I saw him notice me in the mirror, so I stayed still, allowing him to watch.
"You are incredible,"
he said, turning around.
"I like that tattoo on your back. What's that for?"
"Edith Piaf," I said, humming the tune for him. "My mother used to listen to her all the time when I was little. It was her favorite song."
"Very sexy,"
he said, trailing his fingers down the words. He shook his head.
"What is someone like you doing with an old man like me?"
"You're not old."
"Oh, but I am. Do yourself a favor and find a nice young man."
He kissed me, slowly this time. It felt like I thought it would with Matthew, more sure somehow, more grown up than the boys I had been with previously.
"And with that, I must go."
He took his suit jacket from the back of the chair.
"I bought a present for you, by the way."
He pointed at the table with the plastic kettle and the glass box full of tea bags, sachets of sugar and UHT milk, and sure enough, there was a green paper bag underneath it.
"Matthew, you shouldn't have. I can't believe you."
"It's only small,"
he cut me off.
"Don't get too excited."
"Okay," I said, "but thank you anyway." In Stonybatter, I sat at the kitchen table, the chair nudging back and forward on the uneven lino. Dust glistened in the light from the old reading lamp that Fionn had stolen from his mother when we moved in. I stared at it, watching the particles in their twisting dance. There was a deep ache in my thighs already, my face raw from the scratch of his stubble. I stayed there for a long time. When I remembered that I was at home and I was still holding Matthew's present, I peeled away the pinstriped paper carefully, like Nana Kathleen taught me to do.
"We can reuse that," she'd say, putting it in the press for safekeeping. "Sticks and stones,"
Nana would say when I came home crying because the other girls sneered when they saw the birthday presents I gave them were wrapped in second-hand paper.
"They're only words, Sarah. They can't hurt you if you don't let them."
but words can hurt when no one wants to sit next to you on the bus or choose you for their Red Rover team or invite you to their house to play. Words can hurt when nobody likes you. Things were better in secondary school. I had friends, Ashling and Kira, to eat lunch with, boys approaching me at the disco, asking if I would shift their friends. I was calling myself an artist then, rich jeans and black nail varnish, listening to obscure bands that the boys from the presentation college professed to like, but my friends hadn't even heard of. "You're not like other girls," my boyfriends told me, and I agreed. If I'd learned anything at the convent, it was how to pretend to be something I was not. Matthew's present was an art book, one I'd told him I was waiting until payday to buy because it was too expensive. He had said that it sounded ridiculous.
Anorexic models prancing around for gay photographers.
"You're being such a dick," I told him.
"It's been a while since anyone has called me a dick,"
he replied, amused. "Sarah, I just opened the present. Thank you so much. I love it." An hour passed, waiting, waiting. And finally, "Matthew."
"Not at all. Glad you like it."
"Sarah, I'll thank you properly the next time I see you. We should go for dinner when you're back from Tokyo. Can't have you getting the wrong idea." Winky face. I sat there, waiting for a reply. My arms were bare, and I could see speckled skin where his fingers had prodded and dug in, marking their territory. I knew I would be bruised tomorrow. It was exciting, I told myself.
"Oh," Fionn said, "I didn't hear you come in."
He opened the fridge and grabbed a packet of cooked ham. He had that dazed look on his face that he got when he was in the middle of a painting, when he could only stop to go to the bathroom or to eat something as fast as he could, as if talking to someone might break the spell, cut the brush out of his hands before he could finish. "Fionn," I said, and his shoulders tensed, "I need to talk to you."
"Is it important, Fitz? I'm kind of in the middle of something."
"No." I looked at my phone again. "No, it's not important." Now. Sarah woke early, unable to sleep in the sticky heat.
"I don't know how they expect farmers to make a living in this kind of weather. Hottest July on record,"
her father told her when she phoned home. "Really, Dad?" she said every time. "That's interesting." Oisin turned to her, his hand under her pajama bottoms. She wanted to say no, but when she tried to think of the last time they had done this, she couldn't remember. So Sarah let Oisin have sex with her, felt him moving inside her, and she closed her eyes and thought of Matthew. She thought of Matthew wanting her, taking his pleasure from her in whatever way he desired, and she came with a sharp cry. She got out of bed, closing the bathroom door as Oisin asked,
"Are you okay?"
Behind the freestanding bathtub was a mirrored wall. "Kinky," she had said to Oisin when they moved in, and he had stood her in front of the mirror and taken her clothes off, making her watch what he was doing to her. Oisin was the only man who had ever made her come.
"What do you like, Sarah?" he said. "What do you want me to do?"
And she told him, whispered her needs to him in the dark of night. Why hadn't Matthew done the same? Didn't he care? There were so many things Sarah wanted to ask Matthew these days, but knew that she could not. Sometimes she felt as if she would go mad with the not asking. Her body was softer now than when she had been with Matthew. She had been thin then, sharp collarbones and jutting ribs.
"You're in such good shape,"
he would tell her, which somehow made Sarah want to eat everything in sight, while simultaneously vowing never to consume solid food again.
"Your body is incredible."
Sarah had long been aware of the power she could exert over men, of the effect her body had on them. She had learnt that lesson when she was 12 years old, and a man had screamed crude obscenities at her from the safety of his passing car. But even then, she knew that it shouldn't be used for her own pleasure. Her body was there to be looked at, to be admired by others, and, as such, it would never entirely belong to her.
Sexy bitch,
Matthew would say, and then ejaculate on her back or on her stomach.
I'm on the pill, Sarah told him. You can come inside me.
I'm ridiculously fertile, he said. We don't want any accidents now, do we?
And Sarah tried to guess how many other accidents there had been, how many girls had been sent over to England to take care of things. Matthew would pay for it, of course. He was good like that.
Sarah!
It was Usheen, calling her from the bedroom.
Babe, are you okay?
I'm fine.
She could hear him sigh.
If you say so. I'm going downstairs to make breakfast. Do you want scrambled or poached eggs?
They sat at the kitchen table, Sarah's hair frizzing out of its ponytail, Usheen badly in need of a shave. Why would anyone even want to be in a relationship? Matthew used to say to her. People give up, and they start wearing tracksuits around the house. He'd almost recoiled. Until a Chinese takeaway on a Saturday night is the highlight of their week. You're far too young and cool for that, he'd said to her. It's one of the things I like most about you. Sarah had wanted Matthew to like her, so she'd agreed with him. She remained quiet, and he rewarded her by staying. For a while, anyway.
Your mother texted again, Sarah said, picking up her phone to read the message.
Oh, yeah?
Yet another exhibition she wants me to go see with her. That's the fourth one this month. I wish she would just take the hint.
Usheen didn't reply. The scrape of his knife against the plate, the clang of teeth against the metal, the slurping of tea. Sarah slammed her cutlery down with a clatter, and he looked up in surprise.
Are you not enjoying it? He asked her. I made them the way you like.
I've lost my appetite for some reason.
Oh,
he said, continuing to shovel eggs into his mouth.
Did you wash out the saucepan?
What?
The saucepan, you know, the metal thing you use to cook the eggs in, Usheen.
He sneaked a look at the sink.
I didn't get a chance to do it yet.
Jesus fucking Christ, Usheen. You know what scrambled eggs are like. It'll be impossible to clean now.
I told you, I didn't get a chance to do it yet.
Because it's so hard to put some fairy liquid and hot water in a saucepan, is it?
Sarah, Usheen said. Sarah, why are you so angry with me all the time?
What? What are you talking about? I'm not angry with you all the time.
It feels like you are. Like when we had sex earlier, I just...
You just what? If you've got something to say to me, Usheen, then just say it.
Oh, come on, Sarah. I'm sick of feeling like everything I do is wrong. It's not fair to me. This isn't what I signed up for.
Break up with me, then, Sarah thought. Get it over and done with.
Then we can both move on with our lives.
But she just asked,
What do you mean?
Are you still going to Dunfinan for the weekend?
He replied, ignoring her question.
It had been months since Sarah had gone home.
But you're on your summer holidays,
her father said during their phone call yesterday.
Surely you can spare the time now.
She had felt guilty then, so she promised Eddie that she would visit this weekend and that she would bring Usheen. Sarah had been anxious about bringing Usheen to Dunfinan in the beginning, unsure of what Eddie would make of her new boyfriend with his sharp suits and his fancy job in finance, but Usheen had insisted.
I want to spend the rest of my life with you, he'd said. And that means meeting your father.
Eddie had been waiting at the front door, his hand outstretched to shake Usheen's. They hit it off immediately, much to Sarah's disbelief, discussing GAA and the horses, Usheen talking about summers spent on his aunt's farm in West Cork.
That would be on your mother's side, I presume. She's the Irish one, isn't she?
Eddie had asked him, and Usheen nodded, eating the overcooked carrots without complaint. It was late before they went to bed, Eddie showing Usheen to the spare bedroom where Nana Kathleen used to sleep.
He's a nice lad,
Eddie said to Sarah.
You deserve someone nice, after everything.
Later, Sarah crawled into the bed next to Usheen.
Sarah, he said, we shouldn't, not here.
Not in your father's house.
But they did.
You're amazing, he said. I've never met anyone like you. I'm so lucky.
And Sarah had felt lucky too.
Of course I'm still going home. Dad wants to see me before my birthday next week, she said now.
You're coming with me, aren't you?
Oisin didn't reply.
Oisin, I've told Dad you're coming. And we went for dinner with your parents on Tuesday. It's only fair that...
It might be better if I don't go down.
Why?
I don't know, he said. Maybe we could do with a weekend apart.
What are you trying to say, Oisin?
Nothing. It's just a weekend apart, he said. It'll give us both some time to breathe.
Then. Why are you calling me? I asked Matthew the first time he phoned.
Is someone dead?
Why would anyone be dead? He said.
Because that's the only legit reason anyone would have for phoning me rather than texting.
Christ almighty.
Seriously, it's rude. You're presuming that I'll have time to talk to you.
Well, do you have time to talk to me?
I might.
You are very annoying,
he said, but he kept talking. He kept phoning, too, telling me about his trips to Hong Kong and New York and Berlin, mentioning new artists that he had come across on his travels that he wanted me to look up. He was funny, charming, successful. He could have whomever he wanted, and for some reason he'd decided that he wanted me. And Matthew Brennan wanting me made me forget about the "you have insufficient funds for this transaction," and the coca noodles for dinner the week before payday, and the "are you coming home to Dunfinan this weekend, love? I miss you." Before I knew it, I was looking forward to his calls, waiting for them. A simple text from him could lift my entire day, and I became uneasy when they didn't arrive as frequently as I wanted, bordering on euphoric when they did.
"You're positively giddy,"
Stephen said as I shimmied around the staff room when Matthew had texted me after 2 days of silence.
"What's going on?"
I imagined telling Stephen, his reaction. Florence finding out, Mrs. Burke jumping at any opportunity to reprimand me for my lack of professionalism, losing my job, moving back to Dunfinan and that single bed, and my father mentioning a great position going in the convent. I was putting so much in jeopardy being with this man. What was he risking to be with me in return? I told myself that it was not worth it, that Matthew was not worth it. I told myself I had to be careful. "I'm going to break it off," I said to Fionn when Matthew hadn't texted me back again. I had confessed to Fionn about Matthew after that first time in room 63, showing him the text messages so I could get his opinion. "You're a man, Fionn. What do you think of this? Look at this one, Fionn. He put an X in this one. He never puts an X after his text messages. What do you think this one means? And what do you think this one means? And this one? And this one?" "It's too much hassle and he's not even my type," I said. "He's obsessed with CrossFit of all things. I mean, it's pathetic at his age. He never laughs at my jokes, he just says very funny, but I'm expected to find him hilarious, of course, and..."
"Cool,"
Fionn said, leaving the kitchen or the living room or wherever we were hanging out, to go into the tiny studio upstairs, closing the door firmly behind him. "You never listen to me anymore, dude," I said, and Fionn sighed and asked why I couldn't talk about Matthew to my other friends. Why did it always have to be him?
Because
you're not allowed to, I guess,
Fionn said.
"It's not that I'm not allowed to tell anyone," I said. "It's for my own protection. Matthew doesn't want me to have to deal with the drama I would get if it hit the papers."
"Why would anyone give a fuck about who some CEO is dating?"
"It's not about him," I said. "It's because of her, Florence Kavanagh. The papers are obsessed with her."
"Matthew Brennan must have loved that,"
Fionn muttered under his breath. Later that evening, I was still talking about Matthew as I watched Fionn finish a painting. I was sitting on the landing, never able to go all the way into his studio these days, as if an invisible line had been drawn across the entrance. He was using the thin edge of a blade to scrape at the canvas, and I itched to do the same. Then I thought of my work at DAC, trying and trying, only to be told that it was a good effort, Sarah, and I curled my fingers into my palms. I would rather have cut them off, one by one, than fail again.
"The reality is," Fionn said to me, "the situation with Matthew was bothering you the way it is. So why don't you say it to him?"
"Say what to him?"
"That you don't want to meet him in that shitty hotel anymore."
"It's not shitty."
"You just said it was shitty."
"It's not the best,"
I admitted.
"It's not like he can't afford better."
"Yeah, but we might meet someone we know in a nice hotel in town."
"Someone we know?"
"Fine, we might meet someone that Matthew knows."
"And that would be so terrible because..."
"Because we're not ready to tell anyone yet."
"But you're not happy with the way things are, right?"
Fionn asked. I paused, glad that Fionn was looking at the painting rather than at me.
"I could be happier, I guess."
"Grand, tell him that."
"I can't just tell him that, Fionn."
"Why not?"
"Because..."
"Because what?"
"Because it's not that simple."
He groaned.
"I can't keep having this conversation with you, Fitz."
And he threw the paintbrush into the tin of water, wiped his hands on the ragged cloth, and left without saying another word.
"I am going to break it off," I said aloud when he was gone. "I am."
But then Matthew texted. "I'll give it another week," I told myself. "It's too soon." He texted again, and again, and before I knew it, I was back where I'd started, knocking on the door of room 63, waiting for Matthew.
"Your legs are fantastic,"
he told me. He had lifted them over his shoulders earlier, thrusting in deep. It hurt when we had sex like that, gritted teeth and chafing skin, but Matthew liked it.
"I grew them myself,"
I joked, and he curled his body around mine.
"Very funny for a girl."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Women aren't funny, are they?"
"Oh, God," I said, trying to pull away, but he tightened his grip until I stopped fighting. I closed my eyes, breathing in sweat and his expensive cologne, and I felt dizzy with wanting. Wanting him, wanting money, wanting to feel happy, wanting my life to finally begin. And I didn't know what I wanted. All I knew was that I wanted so much.
"Okay," he said, letting go of me.
Matthew was always the first one to step back, to get dressed, to leave. And every time I felt as if I had failed a test I didn't even realize I was taking.
"I have to go. There's a conference call with L.A. in an hour."
"You're so busy and important," I said. "Are we talking millions?"
"Of course."
"So," I said as he thoroughly soaped his hands in the bathroom, always so eager to wash the smell of us off his skin. "When will I see you again?"
"I'm not sure," he replied. "I have to go to Paris next week, business mostly, but I'm hoping to extend it by a few days."
"By yourself?" I asked. A French girl, roughly dried hair, a cigarette hanging between wet lips. She told Matthew that she didn't care what he did or who else he saw, but unlike me, she meant it.
"Yeah," he said, coming back to the bed. "I prefer traveling alone."
"I lived in Paris for a summer when I was at college," I told him. "It was incredible. You have to go to Père Lachaise. I know it's a cliché, but I used to hang out by Edith Piaf's grave there all the time. That's when I got my tattoo."
"Ah, yes," he said, bending down to kiss the tattoo. "My own little bullseye."
I flinched.
"What?"
he said.
"Nothing,"
I said. He got dressed with the precise efficiency he seemed to do everything with. Socks, underwear, shirt, trousers, shoes, belt. The routine never varied. I picked his coat up from the back of the chair.
"Alexander Wang?"
I said as I handed it to him.
"Very trendy, as you old folks like to say."
He shrugged it on, then pulled me closer to him, wrapping the sides of the coat around me, and I leaned my head against his chest, listening to his heartbeat.
I have to go.
He said it again.
I'll call you, okay?
Yeah, cool, I said. Be good. I stayed there after he left, sitting on the bed, trying to summon up the energy to move. The crumpled sheets, the thin window panes letting through a whistling wind. It felt cheap, and I shivered, as if the dampness of the room was seeping into my bones. I looked down at my naked body, the promise of bruises dusting my inner thighs, and I grabbed the duvet to cover it up. I didn't want to see what I had done to myself. My phone was the first thing I looked at when I woke up in the morning. I stared at the screen on the dart to work. I kept it half hidden under my desk, so I would be able to see if it lit up, my heart pressing into my spine when I had a message, please, please, but then it wasn't from him. I felt a flash of irrational hatred for the person that had bothered to text me, and then I started waiting again. Another text would arrive, but it wasn't from him, and it wasn't from him, and then it wasn't from him again. 2 weeks passed, and he hadn't texted me.
Are you okay?
The lads in the house asked, when I said I was going to bed early again. Sarah, is something the matter? They asked me in work, when I sat silently in the staff room, cramming chocolate biscuits into my mouth. I didn't even like them. Matthew preferred it when my body was made up of edges. But they were filling the hole in my stomach, the hole of not good enough, and not pretty enough. And him pulling my hair back, tight, and a sharp palm to flesh, tender flesh but willing, always willing, and you like that, don't you, Sarah? And I said yes, and I looked at him with wanting eyes because that's what he liked. He liked it so much that it must have been good for me, too. Dad, what time will you be home this weekend?
Dad, I presume you are coming home.
Dad, I hope you haven't forgotten, Sarah. Dad, the mass is organized and everything. Dad, are you getting my texts? I was at Houston Station. Tomorrow was the 25th of May, and I always went home at this time of year. It was important. Train ticket in one hand, overnight bag in the other. The robotic voice saying, "The train now standing at Platform 3 is the 5 o'clock service to Cork." I checked my phone to see what time it was, and there it was. A message from Matthew. He was sorry that he hadn't texted, he said. Work had been crazy. He had been travelling. "Come meet me now," he said. And so I did. Ducking past the reception in the hotel, the lift, the worn-out carpet, room 63. "Sarah," he said, and without warning he was inside me, fucking me against the wall, his face contorting. I wondered why men never felt embarrassed about their facial expression as they came, when I almost felt compelled to practice mine to make sure that it looked attractive enough.
"Fuck," he said. "Fuck, you feel so good."
In the bathroom afterwards, I stared at my reflection. My face was flushed, a rash bleeding its way down my neck and onto my chest. I licked my fingers and rubbed the smudged eyeliner, wishing I could get into the shower and scrub my entire body clean, make it forget what just happened to it. I should have been on the train, going to Dunfinan. I had never been away from home on her anniversary before. I could see Matthew in the reflection, stretched out on the bed, his phone in his hand. "I can't keep doing this." His eyes on mine in the mirror.
"What do you mean?"
he asked. "This, us, whatever this is," I said. "I need..."
"More," he said, as if he had been expecting this. "You need more."
I turned to face him. "I'm sick of meeting in this hotel. It'd be nice to actually go for dinner sometime and not be treated like I'm a fucking whore that you hired for the evening." He winced.
"Please don't swear, Sarah. I don't like it when girls swear."
"You sound like Eddie."
"Who's Eddie?"
"My father," I said, my voice rising.
How am I supposed to remember his name? He asked. You always call him Dad.
Because I remember. I remember everything about you.
Look, I'm sorry if you're feeling as if I'm taking advantage of you, Sarah. That was never my intention. I thought we were having fun.
We are, I said.
I completely understand if you don't want to see me anymore.
What? That's not what I said.
No, you're right. You deserve better. And I wish I could be the one to give it to you, but I can't, he said. So if you want to end things, he continued, I get it.
I don't want to end things. I never said that.
You want to keep seeing me?
I want to keep seeing you, but...
Well, if you want to keep seeing me, what's the problem?
He pushed himself off the bed, and with each step that he took towards me, I forgot what I'd been going to say. Because he was here with me now, and that was all I had wanted anyway.
We're still having fun, aren't we?
Yes, I said. Yes.
It's not just sex for me, Sarah. I hope you know that.
He kissed me, silencing me before I could ask him for more. His words sliced through my skin, humming in my throat with what they could mean, the promise of them. I can wait, I told myself. I've always been good at waiting.
Why didn't you come home?
Dad, I can't really talk right now.
I don't care, Sarah. Why didn't you come home? I bought your ticket and everything. All you had to do was get on the train.
There was an emergency at work, Dad. I was stuck in a meeting until 5:30 and I missed the train. It wasn't my fault.
Why didn't you phone me? I was standing at Clonmel for over an hour.
I'm sorry, but it wasn't my fault.
I kept trying to call you.
I couldn't look at my phone during work, could I?
You said you would come home. This weekend of all weekends, you promised me, Sarah.
Dad, I can come home tomorrow morning. I'll get an early train.
No, don't bother. I just...
His voice faltered.
I never wanted you to forget about her.
Dad?
I couldn't breathe.
Dad, of course I'm not going to forget her. That's not possible.
The phone went dead. I put it back in my bag, waiting at the traffic lights to cross in front of the courts of justice. I made my mind go blank, like I used to do when I was a child and my mother had just died. Nana Kathleen wasn't living with us then. It was only the two of us left behind, trying to survive. My father sitting at the kitchen table when the last of the cousins had gone home, rocking back and forth, one hand over his mouth to muffle the high-pitched noise, like an animal with its leg caught in a trap.
Men weren't supposed to cry. Men were supposed to be brave.
Daddy?
I had said, and I tried to hug him.
Daddy, don't be sad.
My father stared at me, his eyes unseeing, as if he wasn't sure who I was or what I was doing in his house. I wasn't enough for him, either. Now. As a child, it had baffled Sarah how Nana Kathleen and her friends would express surprise when it was Christmas or their birthday or a wedding anniversary. How in God's name is it that time again? They would say, shaking their heads in disbelief that another year had passed and they had found themselves at the exact same date once more, as if they hadn't been expecting it. It was stupid, Sarah would think. Stupid how ill-prepared they were for the way the future carved through their lives, claiming their youth for its own. But when she woke that morning, rubbing the damp off the back of her neck, she understood. It was the 29th of July, and it was her birthday. She was 27. And somehow, she could not believe it. Her mother had been married at her age, and pregnant. Sarah tried to imagine herself married to Oisin, a baby clawing in her stomach, needing sustenance, love, demanding sacrifices, because that's what mothers did for their children. They sacrificed. First their wombs, then their hearts. Children were greedy that way. Sarah unplugged her phone. There were the usual happy birthday messages on Facebook from people she hadn't seen in years. Messages in the WhatsApp group from Kira and Aisling. A text from Usheen saying that he had gone to work early, but he would see her at dinner tonight. "I love you," he said. And Sarah wondered if that was still true. "Dad, happy birthday, love. Have put €100 into your AIB account. Phone you later for a chat." Her mother had always sent her a card. "It's nice to get post, isn't it, pet?" she would say on the morning of Sarah's birthday. "It makes it special." Helen had believed in making birthdays special. Sarah brushed her teeth, wincing at how worn her skin looked in the bathroom mirror, nascent lines forming around her eyes. In the kitchen, there was a package on the table in cream and black paper and an envelope beside it. She unwrapped the box to find a Louis Vuitton handbag from Usheen. It was expensive, she knew, something she would never be able to afford in her salary. She should be grateful to have such a generous boyfriend. The envelope was from William and Una, a voucher for an all-inclusive weekend stay at Ballyfin Hotel. "It'll be good for you and Usheen to get a break," the card said in Una's handwriting. "Fionn, happy birthday. I owe you a drink." Fionn didn't buy her presents anymore. Not after what she had done to him. The doorbell rang, startling Sarah. No one ever came to the Booters townhouse without texting first. Unannounced visitors tended to be Jehovah's Witnesses. "No," Sarah felt like telling them, "I do not want to accept Jesus Christ as my Lord and Saviour. Yes, I'm fine with the fiery pits of hell for all eternity. Thanks for asking." Or local kids raising money for charity, their mams standing behind them, as if daring Sarah to refuse to support orphans in Syria, or jerseys for the local under-12s rugby team. The doorbell rang again, a finger on the buzzer for longer than was strictly necessary. Her phone lit up. Una's name on the screen. "Yes?" Sarah said. "Hi, Sarah, it's Una." "I know," Sarah thought. "Caller ID is amazing." "I'm outside the front door," Una continued. "Is the doorbell broken?" "No," Sarah said. "It's not broken. Give me 2 minutes." Una was standing on the front porch, immaculately dressed in a sleeveless linen top and cropped trousers, blonde hair freshly blow-dried. "Well, there's the birthday girl," she said, kissing Sarah on the cheek. "It's good to see you." "Yes," Sarah said, breathing in. No matter how much expensive perfume Una wore, she always smelled of paint and turpentine, her art stitched to her as tightly as a shadow. If Sarah closed her eyes, she could pretend she was back in the garden shed in Dunfinan, the shed Eddie had told Sarah was hers when she turned 15. "You'll need somewhere to work, sir," he'd said. "You'll be asphyxiated from paint fumes in that room of yours if things carry on the way they are." Sarah could see herself in that tiny space, the killers on her iPod dock, while she finished her Leaving Cert coursework. It was an imaginative composition, based on an old photo hanging in their living room, of Sarah and her mother and Eddie in Tremor. Sarah's first trip to the beach as a child. Sarah remembered feeling as if she was trying to draw blood, drag her memory of that day up from her bones, and scratch it into life on the canvas. Salt tangling hair, skin tightening with sunburn. But Sarah knew that what she really wanted to capture was how it felt to have a mother again. Helen's hand in hers, the weight of it. Both of them ignoring Eddie's fussing about the price of ice creams and how the sand was too hot and how the shells were too sharp and how there was sand in his ham sandwich. Eddie had been 14 years older than Helen, and it was at moments like that when the age gap became most apparent. He looked wrong when he was away from the farm somehow, as if he was posing for an artistic study in his shorts and sandals. Sarah Fitzpatrick. Born 1990. Father at the beach, 1994. Oil on canvas. "Beautiful, Sarah," Miss Ryan, the art teacher, had said when she saw the painting of Sarah's family. That was when Sarah had been the best art student at the convent. That was before she went to college, and discovered 30 other people who had been the best students in their schools too.
"I've been texting you," Una said. "I was hoping you might come to the annual exhibition in the RHA with me. I was supposed to attend the opening shindig, but I had to go to the States with William. He's on tour with a new book, and you know how he gets."
Sarah didn't respond.
"Anyway," Una said, "I thought we could go together. Maybe get lunch in the gallery afterwards. The food is good there. My treat."
"I didn't get any texts from you," Sarah replied. "My phone must be broken." She gestured at her dressing gown and slippers. "You'll have to excuse what I'm wearing. I would have changed if I knew you were coming."
"Oh, it doesn't matter. We can go another time, whenever suits you," she said. There was an awkward pause. "Can I come in then?"
"Oh," Sarah said. "Sorry. Of course, come in, come in."
They walked through the hall into the kitchen, Sarah apologizing for the mess. Magda was sick this week and Oisin said he would tidy up last night, but then he had to have dinner with a client again and he wasn't home until late, so I told him I'd just do it myself, but I haven't had a chance to get around to it yet and...
"It's fine," Una said. "Don't worry about it. This is your house now. You can do what suits you."
"Can I?" Sarah thought, but she smiled at Una anyway, turning on the Nespresso machine and searching the cupboards for biscuits.
"How's William?"
she asked. "That was an incredible review in the New Yorker. You must have been thrilled."
"It was super, wasn't it?"
"Unfortunately, they got the initial sales figures the day after." Una lowered her voice, as if to ensure no one would overhear her.
"And let's just say that they're not quite what we had hoped for."
She picked up the Louis Vuitton bag and stroked the leather.
"This is beautiful. A birthday present?"
"Yes," Sarah said. "From Oisin."
"Isn't he so good? I love Louis Vuitton. But I have to smuggle the Brown Thomas bags into the house when William's at Trinity. He thinks it's a criminal waste of money."
"Well," Sarah said as she placed a cup of coffee in front of Una. She picked up the sugar canister and grabbed milk from the fridge.
"It is your money after all. You can do what you want with it."
"It doesn't quite work like that in a marriage. William and I share everything equally. That's the deal."
That wasn't the deal in Sarah's relationship. There was Sarah's money, and there was Oisin's money. And although Oisin was generous, although Sarah knew that he would give her anything she wanted or asked for, that money still wasn't hers. And ultimately it wasn't Oisin's either. He was paid well as a private client advisor at Bryant, but they both knew that it was Una's money that funded their lifestyle. Una had always supported her men and their artistic ambitions, paying for yet another new guitar for Donal, covering the initial touring costs so the principals could play every small venue in Ireland and build up their rabid fan base, shelling out for acting classes and headshots for Oisin, before he'd decided that he wasn't cut out for the constant rejection of the thespian life. Una's money seemed to mean a lifetime pretending that no, William didn't mind that his critical success wasn't matched by the sale figures, and no, William didn't care that his wife made more money from selling one painting than he did in a year from his award-winning novels. And, Oisin had told Sarah in confidence, in exchange for William not caring, Una's job was to reassure her husband that he was brilliant, that his work was important, necessary, bolstering an ego that was punctured every time he looked at their joint bank account. Was that part of the marriage deal too?
"Yes," Sarah said. They sat in silence, the ting of metal against china as Una stirred milk into her cup, the roar of a lawnmower from next door.
"Martina Morrison still working poor Johnny to the bone?"
"Nonsense, Una," Sarah said. "Mrs. Morrison does all the work herself. It's the green fingers, you see, and God Almighty himself has blessed her with them."
Una snorted. "That woman is lethal. I hope she hasn't been driving you mad."
"Ah, she's harmless."
"So," Una said, taking a sip of her coffee, "what are you doing for your birthday? Anything special?"
"Not much. Just going to chill out, I think. Oisin is taking me to Blowfish later."
"That'll be lovely,"
JJ and Alana are doing an incredible job with the place, aren't they? You should have the monkfish for your main. It's incredible.
I know.
Or the blackened salmon is amazing as well. I would go with either of those two dishes if I were you.
I have been there before, Una.
Of course, Una said, breaking a biscuit in half, but not eating any of it. I'm sorry if I'm annoying you. I only came over today because I wanted to give you your present.
You already gave me a present.
Una frowned, so Sarah forced herself to keep talking.
And thank you. It was very generous.
I'm glad you liked it, Una said dryly. She reached into her handbag, pulling out an envelope. Maybe you'll be more excited about this.
Sarah didn't move.
Well, Una said, aren't you going to open it?
Sarah took the envelope from her. Inside was a 1,000 euro voucher for an art supplies store, the best in Dublin. The one that Fionn and she used to go to when they were students. The same one her father...
Buy yourself some frivolous colours, Una said, her hands gesticulating wildly as she imagined the paints Sarah might choose. Just experiment. Don't worry about the end result. Allow yourself to create for the sake of creating again, rather than thinking about whether it's good or not. I think that's the key to true creativity, don't you? If you look at how children make art, they're so present. They never worry about...
I can't accept this, Una.
What? She stared at Sarah in confusion. Why not?
It's too much money.
Oh, money?
Una said as if the concept was nonsensical.
Money isn't important, Sarah. If you're an artist, then you make art. It's as simple as that.
Maybe money isn't important for you, Una, but for the rest of us it tends to come in handy.
Please don't talk to me like that, Sarah.
Like what?
Like I'm some class of simpleton. Do you honestly think I became an artist to make money? This was the 70s, Sarah, in Ireland. There was no money in the country, and the only option for a woman was to become a teacher or a nurse or to go into the civil service.
Una shuddered at the thought.
Do you think my parents jumped up and down with joy when I said I wanted to go to art school? And then I brought William, of all people, back from London, and told them that this was the man I was going to marry? Well, you can imagine how that went down. She almost laughed. Black and a Protestant? I'm not sure which they thought was worse. My father told me I would die penniless and alone, and that I wasn't to come crying to him for help when that happened.
Her smile faded.
As if I would have asked him for anything.
Sarah rolled her eyes.
Your father was a doctor, Una. I don't think you were exactly facing the mean streets of Dublin now, were you?
My father was a lot of things.
You still had a mother, didn't you? You had your sisters.
Sarah's voice spiked. She was being rude, Nana Kathleen would have told her, but she couldn't stop.
What did I have?
What did you have?
Una banged the cup down on the table.
What did you have? Oh, I don't know, Sarah. Maybe you had a normal father who loved you and supported you and encouraged you to go to art school because all he wanted was for you to be happy.
My father left me in that house when my mother died so he could go on yet another binge with his drinking friends.
Oh my God, would you stop for once?
I'll admit that your father didn't cope well after your mother died. Can you blame him?
Well, Una, maybe he should have paid more attention to her when she was alive. He never seemed to think of that, did he?
That doesn't negate the fact that he had just lost his wife to cancer, Sarah. Grief manifests in strange ways.
I just lost my mother, and I was only a child.
I know, and I'm sorry, she said, but your father did his best.
Didn't he go get professional help to stop drinking? Didn't your grandmother move in to take care of you while he was in the hospital?
She waited for Sarah to nod in acquiescence before continuing.
And didn't your grandmother love you and mind you until your father was well again?
Yes, but...
Sarah was stuttering now, trying to remember her point.
But he left me alone, Una.
Sarah. Una took Sarah's hands in hers.
I'm sorry that happened to you. Truly, I am.
But don't you think you should do something about it? Go to therapy. Read some self-help books. Break up with Oisin if he's making you so bloody miserable. What? Una, you can't just say that to me. What's wrong with you?
I think the real question here, Sarah, is what's wrong with you? Do you think that we don't notice, William and Donal and I, how you treat Oisin? How you snap at him and order him around and pick at every little fault? Do you think that's easy for us to be around?
Sarah flushed. She thought she had been clever, that she had managed to fool the Wilsons into thinking she was the perfect girlfriend and prospective daughter-in-law, and if they had noticed, who else had? Afric? Oisin's friends? His colleagues?
I've tried not to get involved.
Is this what you call not getting involved, Una? Staging some kind of intervention?
Sarah pulled her hands away.
I bet you wouldn't do this to Afric if Oisin was still dating her.
Afric?
I know you prefer her to me. You've made that painfully obvious.
Afric is like a daughter to me, Sarah. I've known her since she was a child, and...
Oh, please. Just because Afric is rich and her family are the fucking Conroys, you think that she's better than me. Poor little Sarah, am I right? Up from the country with her dead mother and her farmer father. Is that it?
Sarah?
Una said through gritted teeth.
I don't know what is wrong with you. Your father is a lovely person. Lovely? I would far rather have him in my house than Charlie Conroy on any day of the week. All that man does is sleep around and blithely ignore the fact that his wife has a chronic eating disorder for the last 25 years.
But Oisin...
What, Oisin, what?
He and Afric dated in secondary school. They were kids. He doesn't want to be with Afric. He wants to be with you.
But I have to ask you, Sarah, do you want to be with him?
Una moved her chair closer to Sarah's.
I know it's impossible to tell what a relationship is like from the outside. Sometimes it only makes sense to the two people involved. God knows there have been times when people have questioned why I stayed with William. If you and Oisin are blissfully happy, then feel free to tell me to get lost. But it doesn't appear that way, and I have to admit that I want my son to be with someone who really loves him. And I think you deserve the same.
She took Sarah's hands in hers again, and this time Sarah didn't pull away.
Are you happy, Sarah?
Sarah dropped her head, willing herself to be strong.
I didn't think so, Una said. Do you want to talk about it?
It's not Oisin, Sarah said. It's not him. He hasn't done anything wrong.
It's what?
Una's voice was gentle. She sat very still, waiting for Sarah to confide in her.
And Sarah wanted to. She wanted to explain to Una about Matthew Brennan, and how he had treated her, and how she couldn't understand why she had allowed it to happen. But the truth was that she had.
Sarah was haunted by that, by her own complicity in the whole affair. Every time she looked in the mirror, she saw a body that could be used for someone else's gratification. She saw a woman who could be easily discarded and forgotten about, as if she was nothing.
I was with a man.
Anne?
And he. And he...
What did he do to you?
Una's hand tightened on Sarah's.
Oh, Sarah, I'm so sorry. Did he hurt you?
He didn't love me,
Sarah said.
If you love someone, you'll do anything to be with them, right? But Matthew just used me for sex. He thought he could treat me whatever way he wanted to, and I let him.
She was talking so fast, she wasn't sure if she was making any sense, but she needed to say this to get it out of her.
I let him treat me like it was a worthless piece of shit that he could fuck whenever he wanted.
Matthew?
Matthew who?
You have to swear you won't tell anyone,
Sarah said. Even after all this time, she continued to keep Matthew's secrets.
Do you promise?
Of course.
Matthew Brennan.
Matthew Brennan? The real estate guy who was married to Florence Kavanagh?
Sarah nodded.
I know him. He sold us a house in Killiney, and I felt like taking a shower after he left. He's an absolute sleaze.
Una lifted Sarah's chin so she looked her in the eye.
You are worth 10 of Matthew Brennan.
No, I'm not.
You are?
You're young and talented, and you have the world at your feet.
Not talented enough, am I?
Sarah.